no, no, boy.
Y'all done up and done it.
Oh, no, no, boy.
Y'all done up and done it.
Oh, no, no, no,
man. Y'all done up and done it. Y'all done up and done it, man. Y'all.
You're listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show, where
we... I got the wrong song for you guys. No, no, you guys, it's been 1 year. You guys deserve this. You deserve this.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
And so are we live right now, Evan? Are
we
you
are.
Telling...
Awesome. Oh, all
so
right.
You're telling all of our listeners, this is our 1 year, folks.
And we're doing
you guys deserve
redo.
This.
And we deserve it.
It's true.
Thanks, Evan. He's our fabulous producer.
New cologne on. Feeling so good. Change the color to my phone. Ringtone. Free car wash. Had to clean up the Dodge. Give back when I can. Just playing my part. Church folks had a fish fry. Mustard. Hot salt. Light bread. French fries. Love for the big guy. Hit the park. Showing off their house, Nappy Roots on the radio. And you know it about last night they hit the big three. Bought some Air Force Ones, four tall tees. Man, I'm loving BG. Still above ground, that's the reason I pray. Got my car cleaned up, now I'm ready to play. Make a call to the stick.
You're listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show, where we uplift caregivers through education and support while also lifting up their invaluable role in society. I'm Liza.
And I'm Kristen.
And together we are the Empowered Caregivers. Today's show is sponsored by Group Health Cooperative of South Central Wisconsin, a nonprofit, member-owned health plan providing high-quality health care and health insurance services to over 85,000 members living in South Central Wisconsin.
Today we have a jammed-packed show, so get comfortable because you are not going to want to miss out. This is 1 year that we've been doing the Empowered Caregiver Show.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! And we are celebrating, and I just want to give a personal thank you to my partner here, Liza Hellenbrand, and our producer, Evan. You guys, you've been making it an excellent, excellent experience. All right, we have Evan Goyke, representative for the 18th Assembly District, and the current mayor from Oshkosh, and representative from the 54th District, Lori Palmieri. Because why have one job when you can have two?
Right.
I mean, Lori, you are really going to put us to shame. And then lastly, we're hoping to be joined by Michelle Dickinson, a caregiver mental health advocate, a TED speaker, and a published author of a memoir entitled Breaking Into My Life, a memoir that offers a rare glimpse into a young girl's experience living with and loving her bipolar mother.
And don't forget that you can hear us, if you missed us out today, you can hear us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And if you like our podcast, please vote for us at channel3000.com for the Best of Madison Awards under the section of Best Podcast. And with that being said, let's get started with our interview with Evan Goyke.
Let's start with Evan Goyke. Thank you so much, Evan, for being here. We are thrilled that you are joining us. But can you please tell listeners why it was important to you to be on a show that supports family caregivers? And do you know any family caregivers in your life?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I've been in office for 11 years, and I would say caregiving, whether it's in home or in a facility setting, in the last 4 to 6 years has really become a top issue and one that we have heard over and over again, its importance and the importance of increasing funding and investment in the workforce and ultimately the care. My personal experience, I was both raised and currently live in a multi-generational household. My mother-in-law has retired at age 60 and cares for my son and my niece. And, you know, we house her here at our house. And, we basically just took the shortcut of daycare and really not being able to find a lot of options in our area that didn't have multi-year waiting lists.
Sure,
you have to get a daycare slot before you even get pregnant these days.
Absolutely.
And so two families went together, to ensure that we had childcare. So,
well, And
yeah,
it's interesting.
I'm living that right now.
Well, and it's interesting that not only do we need slots in daycares, we also need slots in senior centers, right? And so you're also, I mean, not that retirement at 60 means that she's ready to move into a nursing facility of any sort, but you are also taking on that responsibility and sort of building in that multi-generational idea. But I want to circle back to the caregiving piece. So you said you're here, you've been in office for a while, and thank you for your service. And as we've seen the issues rising to the top more in the last few years, what do you think is causing that?
Well, I think that many caregivers have suffered in silence for decades, and I don't think that it was an easy job ever, or that it's an easy job. I think it's an underappreciated role. In the world of politics, it's a job that I think many elected officials don't fully understand. They kind of don't know what it entails. And so, you know, unlike a plumber or an attorney or something, you know, it's kind of common understanding of what that job might entail. I think many people in office don't really respect or understand what care providers really do and the importance that they play in the healthcare ecosystem and to their patients and clients. And so what we have heard is really a hollowing of the workforce due to stagnated wages, due to kind of, this is all a domino, right? These are dominoes falling from the top of the hill, and the top of the hill really is the state and federal government and reimbursement rates and rates that under Medicare or Medicaid that we are reimbursing or paying for care, which when they're not raised, wages don't get raised. And, you know, and then you factor in inflation. And so paying somebody $8, $9, $10 an hour, you know, has, I think, because the rates haven't increased for a long time or didn't increase for a long time, you had major, major wage pressure.
Sure.
And lots of high amounts of turnover. And it became an industry in crisis, I think, earlier than the pandemic and earlier than other industries that, you know, we're hearing that kind of labor workforce shortage all across the state now. And especially home health care, I think, felt it 2016, 2017.
Exactly.
And so we started to hear from folks statewide.
Yeah, I definitely can agree with that. And it makes me think of a conversation that I had with my husband last night. Our teenage son just started a new job at a fast food restaurant, and he is making $16 an hour. And our son that has autism has IRIS funding, and I think he is eligible for respite care, respite providers at $13 an hour. So why would anybody go do, you know, a physically, emotionally taxing job when they can go, you know, to their local gas station or fast food restaurant and make more money?
Right. And that's not to diss. I just want to make sure that we're not dissing that work, right?
Right, right.
That's very essential work too. Excuse me. And then I agree with you that the pandemic put a real big focus on the healthcare issue in terms of labor shortage and unfair wages and no benefits, but it was there beforehand. And as you pointed out, it's a domino effect. And I always forget about the fact that it's tied to the reimbursement. I just attach it to the fact that it's, I'm a bit of a feminist. And so I attach it to the fact that it's disproportionately been a job that women have held. And because women have had all these dual roles in society historically, they don't always have the power to organize and assert themselves to get the like proper labor representation. But it is interesting to know that we have to go back to that funding. And so is that something that we approach you as the legislators for, that we ask for greater reimbursement coming from Medicare? Is it always Medicare or is it Medicaid as
Medicare,
well?
Medicare, Medicaid.
Okay.
Both, either, I think. It depends on the population being served.
Sure.
You know, the other factor in here is in this example that we were just using, a large-scale fast food chain has ways of handling wage increases. They can, you know, increase costs, et cetera. You know, if the price of a burger goes up, you know, customers are still willing to pay that, you know, where many of the providers or the people that actually hire the providers, these are very small entities that are often mom and pop run, you know, that have been within a family. They, you know, serve a geographic area. It's not, you know, there really aren't many national corporate entities that are doing this type of work.
Great
it's
point.
Really, and so there isn't a way for these organizations to fundraise outside. Are they supposed to do a bake sale? Are they supposed
right.
to, you know, they're not. So that we're seeing this across the board. We're seeing it with, you know, nurses, teachers, et cetera, where entities that rely on government funding, and having a government, largely the legislature, the governor, and we can talk about the governor's proposals. If the public sector isn't willing to increase wages, and in this setting, we do that through a higher reimbursement rate, which is, you know, more money for the services, which can in turn be used for wage increases. If we can't compete with the private sector, we're in big, big trouble. And the people being served are in big trouble. And in this conversation, we're talking about the most vulnerable people in our community. And this is just a side note. It may cost more, and it those individuals are worth the investment, but it's also going to save money in the long run. You know, providing care in home and keeping people out of long-term care facilities is actually radically cheaper than way we used to do things.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to add. When these people can't get help in their home, then they have no choice to go into some kind of assisted living, which falls on the taxpayers at thousands of dollars a year. And then, you know, going back to the kind of the Great Exodus, I don't know what kind of studies or research has been done as far as who those people were that were leaving, but we know that a large portion of them were caregivers, because the people that were watching, you know, their loved ones so they could go to work couldn't do that, so they had to stay home. And that was kind of Kristen's example when she was a public teacher, our school teacher in the public schools, and they closed. And I'll let you tell your story. Why am I telling your story?
That's okay. Well, it was tough. It was exactly what everybody's been talking about, that I now was trying to be a family caregiver to my daughter with three different disabilities, as well as teach my students from my basement. And, you know, we just lost more and more people. And, you know, I always say we actually are lucky to have money to help get people for Nicole. There just aren't people to get, because it isn't competitive with the fast food, you know, restaurants and the other type of entry level jobs. So you
called me on to provide a little bit of a what can we do about it, and I want to make sure that listeners understand that in this spring, right now, the governor has introduced his proposed 2-year state budget, which will cover, you know, again, the next 2 years, and the legislature will debate this over the next 4 or 5 months. And so the action item for listeners, the governor's proposed budget has, I don't know, maybe a dozen different areas of investment in this space. I think roughly $90 million directly for home health care providers.
Okay.
And so get active, call your state representative, call your state senator. We are driven by stories, the stories of your children, your loved ones, your grandparents, whomever. I'm newly excited to engage in this work because I recently had a kid, and boy, would we be nowhere without, you know, paid leave for my mother-in-law who's helped take care for my son. So tell your stories, get active, call your senator. There's a lot in this state budget that will help.
Thank you, Evan, so much for joining us. There's so much that we could talk about. I hope we can have you on again.
Happy to be back.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Good night. You have been listening to Representative Evan Goyke from the 18th District. After this break, Lori Palmieri is going to tell us how Oshkosh is a leader in the state in finding affordable housing options and how that benefits family caregivers.
Empower Caregiver Show with Liza Hellenbrand and Kristen Voss. We're here now with Lori Palmieri, the outgoing mayor of Oshkosh and first-time representative of the 54th District. Lori and I had the pleasure of talking the other day on the phone, and I know that you have a long caregiving story. You did some caregiving for your mother as well as currently for your granddaughter. So from a generational standpoint, you have experienced both ends of the spectrum. system. And when I asked you what you felt was most important to address to support family caregivers, non-driver transportation was one thing that came up, but then you started talking about what Oshkosh is doing with accessory dwelling units. And I have been working in real estate for 25 years, and I do not know of anybody in the state of Wisconsin that is doing this. So I'm sorry, I'm going to steer you in that direction. But if you could just start out by telling listeners what an accessory dwelling unit is, what Oshkosh is doing, and why do you think that'll benefit caregivers?
Yes, I'm excited to share this because it's been years in coming. And I do want to point out, I was on a website today, just kind of refreshing my memory about other communities and where things were at on accessory dwelling units. Accessory dwelling units are smaller, independent residential dwelling units that are located on the same lot as a standalone, like detached single family home, or in some cases, you know, it may be a larger home. But the accessory dwelling unit ordinances, if you will, and zoning specifics are many and they are varied. But I do want to point out, it does appear that Madison has this as an option. So I don't know what other cities currently have passed. I know some have looked at it. Some have shied away, and others are moving forward. So with that said, I don't want to say that we are the only one. And quite honestly, we just had our zoning code, city council consider our zoning code and our chapter 30 to allow for this for our first reading at our last meeting. And on the 28th of February, we will have the second hearing. And I'm very confident and hopeful that it will pass.
Lori, I'm going to ask you a question off script here a little bit, just because I'm so excited about this idea. I have an adult daughter with three different disabilities, and I'm really struggling with the best way to support her having some type of independence living in a different situation. And I would love this idea. So who was behind suggesting it in Oshkosh? Was it family caregivers, or are there other uses?
No, not necessarily, but you know, around the country, you've heard you may have heard the term granny flat, in the South and the Southwest, the casita. You know, these are not new. I will say that we first started talking about this probably, I want to say, 10 years ago.
Yeah,
10 years ago, and it wasn't until the last couple of years that we started working on our housing plan for Oshkosh to add to our housing stock. And that's just one component of adding to our housing stock. And, you know, we had the expensive consultants and all of that to kind of, you know, encourage some of these maybe non-traditional living arrangements. And so, I am really excited that we're going to start seeing more of these. You know, they can be somewhat costly depending upon whether you're looking at a separate unit, or if it's converting an attic or an addition to the home. I mean, ideally, it's again going to have a separate entrance, maybe, you know, separate bathing, sleeping, and maybe kitchenette. There are some companies out there here in the Fox City, at least one that I know of. Can I say the name of a company?
You sure can.
Sure.
Give them a shout out. Thanks for checking. Why not? If they're doing great stuff, we want to support them.
Yeah, it's called Linked Living. And I first heard about them probably 5 years ago. They were just kind of getting going. And small company, they were looking at building these modular, separate living facility or dwelling units, but linking them to like the main house, especially in terms for elderly or folks with mobility issues, you know, to give some separate privacy and dignity, but also that kind of immediate response and, you know, if assistance is needed. So it can really serve, I think, a number of folks, not just the elderly, right? And it could be, you know, like you say, a young adult or another generation or another person who wants to have that separation, but wants to be in a cohesive, you know, family, a larger family unit.
Well, exactly. That's why I got so excited about it, right? So Nicole's only 21, but she's somebody with an intellectual disability, autism, and epilepsy. So we can't really have her living independently like many 21-year-olds or even living with other 21-year-olds, right?
Yes.
So I'm loving this. And in just a moment, we'll come back and talk a little bit more about this, as well as hear your views on non-driver transportation.
You're listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show with Liza and Kristen. Be sure to join us next week as we talk with State Representative Melissa Radcliffe from Cottage Grove and Julie Caracino, I probably just butchered that last name, from Reawaken Your Brilliance, who will be talking about how preparing for death allows us to live more freely.
I'm looking forward to that. But right now, I'm really engaged in our conversation with mental health advocate Michelle Dickinson, and we've been talking about mental health in the workplace. We're now going to shift gears and talk about what got you involved in all this mental health crusade. And I would imagine, because for most of us, it has a lot to do with our upbringing. So would you mind sharing with listeners about your childhood story and what it taught you, please?
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, so I grew up with a mother who had bipolar disorder, and that experience shaped me. And it wasn't something that I really spoke about because it was very stigmatized when I was young. And I found myself working a corporate job, minding my own business, and then someone learned about that story and nominated me to give a TED Talk. So I gave the TED Talk about my mom and the experience, what it was like growing up with her, how volatile it was. And the reception of that TED Talk was really what inspired me to go on and write my memoir, because what it has the tendency to do when you go first is you create like the safe space for other people. And I was just so moved by the reaction of the talk that I was like, I have to write this in a book. And I think I could actually make a difference for people. So I went on, wrote the book, and then experienced my own depression. So I got that perspective, and then helped to build a employee resource group and create more compassion in the workplace around mental health. So
I saw that when I was looking on your website. I'm like, you are our type of person, the person that tries just to do it all, right? You've got your hands out in all these different pots, tons of great work that you're doing, and I appreciate it, and I thank you for it. I want to go back to your book. What do you think that is the biggest takeaway from the book, or what would readers expect to learn from it?
Yeah. So that book is really a story about what it's like to love and care for someone with a mental illness. My whole goal with writing the book was to humanize mental health and was to show people a story of perseverance and triumph. Because listen, we all have stuff in our childhood that shapes us, and it's our choice if we want to be the victim of that or if we want to be someone who can navigate that, work through that, and then move on and create the life that they want. So ultimately, it's a story of perseverance and triumph. It takes you on the journey of what it was like through my childhood, my adolescent years, and then my young adult years and my adult life. The epiphanies that I had at the epilogue in the back of the book highlights how grateful I am ultimately for all of those experiences, because I would never be doing this work.
Isn't that beautiful? I sometimes say the same thing about being a mother to Nicole. You know, a lot of people say to me, wow, you've got a lot on your plate, which is an expression I can't stand, because as I was explaining to someone today, it puts me in this vision of I'm walking through a cafeteria line and just adding more and more to my cafeteria tray. And it's like, I didn't want all this when it comes to life with a daughter with a lot of special needs. But I do have a lot of gratitude for it now as she's 21, because I am able to recognize what I've learned from it. So I think it's beautiful that you are also saying that. And so I'm going to just ask you to share one more thing about learning. It's our favorite question to ask our guests. What are three things that you would like all family caregivers, based on your experience with resilience work, the employment, your own job and role as a family caregiver to your mother. What are three things that you wish all family caregivers knew?
The importance of not foregoing their own well-being. Mm-hmm. You know, as a little girl caring for my mom, I didn't know better. I would just give and give and give and then give some more. So you absolutely have to make self-care. It's a critical aspect of being able to care for others. So self-care, becoming aware of your mindset and the self-chatter can derail anybody, but especially a caregiver.
I
would say, yeah, check your mindset, and stay connected to community. Community is a great resource. So stay connected. Staying connected is probably one of the most important things you can do, because it reminds you you're not alone.
Right. Well, that's great. That's a big part of our mission. And before we go, we want to give you the opportunity with the mic to tell us a little bit about what you'd like to promote and how people can find you, please.
Sure. So the work I'm doing now, I'm kind of going where the energy is, and the energy tells me people need resilience coaching and they need resilience strategies in the workplace. So the work I'm doing now is coaching one-on-one, a lot of educators, a lot of, corporate people, individuals, but then workshops in the workplace, if you really want to shift culture and create more understanding and empower your leaders, do that through workshops. And you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm always on LinkedIn. It's my second home. Or if you want to just grab some free resilience tips, you can follow me on TikTok, Resilience Coach Michelle.
Okay. Resilience Coach Michelle on TikTok. And then where do we find you on Indeed?
Not Indeed.
No, on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn. Whoops.
You can tell how often she uses LinkedIn, huh?
Or Indeed, or any of them. Yeah. I just see the commercials and I'm like, I got to get with the times.
I know. Baby steps. We'll get you connected to that social media. So LinkedIn, but then also you have a website as well, right? MichelleEDickinson.com?
Yeah, you can go there, or you can go to Care for Your People. It's always better to get most current information. I'm always posting on LinkedIn, articles and information. So probably LinkedIn is the better place.
Excellent. This has now motivated me to go update my LinkedIn account that I think I made back in 2010. I don't even know.
You don't even know who's out there. You don't even know the men that might be trying to date you or get to know you.
Exactly.
Or the job offers.
On that note, well, let's wrap it up with poor Michelle. She doesn't want to listen to my stuff.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for coming, especially I know it's extra late where you're at. I really appreciate your conversation. Absolutely loved the three things that you had for all family caregivers. That was spot on. Couldn't have said it better. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Michelle. Good night.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Liza, what an exciting show this has been. We've been all over the map, right?
We've
had Evan, and then we had Lori, and then Michelle. So we got to talk about really relevant political topics and then all this really relevant stuff in terms of mental health and how to advocate for ourselves in the employment arena.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to go to bed tonight.
It was a very happy first anniversary.
It was.
For
it
us.
Was. So here's to raising our glasses and saying cheers.
Cheers to us.
Evan, here's cheers to you,
bud. Yes. And we know that caregiving can be overwhelming and exhausting. So that's why we want to end each show on a positive note with "You got this." And together we are stronger. So stay connected to the empowered caregiver community.
Yes. Because we want to keep sharing and giving motivation and support to our community.
Yes. And on that note, before I forget, if we have a second left, is to be sure to go to our website and nominate a family caregiver for one of our free gift boxes. We absolutely would love to be able to share that with deserving family caregivers. All we need to know is the name, the story, the address, and we'll get it to them.
Yep. It's not a lot of work for you, so let's do this together, everybody. Good night.
Thank you.
And I said, you know, instead of waiting for a good day to happen, you know, waiting around through ups and downs, you know, I just said, look.
Listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show with Kristen Voss and Liza Hellenbrand. We've been talking with Lori Palmieri, outgoing mayor of Oshkosh and now first-time representative of the 54th District. In a few moments, we'll be talking with mental health advocate, Michelle Dickinson. But before she comes on, I want to make sure that I do two things. One, remind listeners to go to our website, empoweredcaregivercommunity.com. And again, that's empoweredcaregivercommunity.com, and sign up for our 6-week online free course, Powerful Tools for Caregivers, which starts April 12th. So Lori, before we transition to Michelle, I had asked you right before the break, what are your perspectives or thoughts about the non-driver transportation issue and how that is something that impacts family caregivers?
Well, certainly having cared for my mother, who was a user of an electric wheelchair, and also a user of public transit, you know, certain limitations there. My 17-year-old granddaughter lives with epilepsy, and she is reliant upon us as, you know, driving as many people are with teens, but also she will be into her young adult life. And public transit hours are very restricted, you know, in some communities, if the communities even have it, right? Certainly after 6 p.m., it's a no-go. It's maybe Uber, but really the other piece of this is that there are programs, there's a patchwork of programs, at least here in Winnebago County, Make the Ride Happen. It's volunteer-based, and it's dependent upon scheduling way ahead of time, number one. Number two, how many volunteers are available in their schedules. There's public and paratransit, but again, not good for after hours or on weekends in some communities. So, I mean, this non-driver transportation is a significant issue for caregivers because you are, you know, the sole provider outside of those other options.
Oh, don't I know it?
Yes, exactly.
That's what my life consists of. I'm Uber mom. So, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I just want to thank you for taking the time this evening to be with us and all the information that you shared and all the wonderful work that you did up in Oshkosh. I love Oshkosh. It's mm-hmm. It's my second favorite place besides my hometown. But great things you're doing there. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks,
yes,
Lori.
Thank you.
Good night.
And now we're going to transition over to Michelle Dickinson, who is a mental health advocate, TED Talk speaker, and author. Michelle, can you tell listeners a little bit more about the work that you do?
Sure. And thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. So I mostly am a coach around resilience, but I am a workplace mental health strategist as well. So I'm working with organizations to really boost resilience and help people leaders lead in a post-pandemic world, because we have so many people who are struggling coming out of the pandemic with some type of a mental health challenge. So we need to create more compassionate environments, but we also need to equip our leaders with how do they support a staff member if they're struggling? And then I'm also a resilience coach for many, many educators here in the New Jersey area, but I'm also a resilience coach for corporate organizations that just want to provide coaching for their people as well.
Michelle, I love it. I am currently a public school teacher here in Madison, and I did just put in my paperwork for retirement, and I have struggled around that resilience issue, and I love the terminology you're using. I taught psychology, so resilience was something that came up in my classroom and some of the work from psychology professors around resilience, so thank you for that. And we know that this is also something that's affecting family caregivers, which is a big part of why we wanted to bring you on, right? Family caregivers deal with depression at twice the rate as the general population. Approximately 75, that's a huge percentage. Approximately 75% of caregivers under the age of 50 also work. So can you tell listeners how you're working to destigmatize mental health in the workplace?
Sure. So there's a couple of different ways. So as a mental health advocate and a workplace strategist, it depends where companies are in opening up the conversation and really providing enhanced mental health support for their people. Some organizations just ask me for a keynote, go first, open the door, create some comfort around this topic. Other organizations want me to really equip their people and really help their people leaders understand how to support their people, but also boost up strategies where people can start just doing better to create more balance in their life. And then encouraging leaders to go first. So I have a couple different ways that I work with organizations to really create safe environments, psychologically safe environments. And it does you know, help when leaders are willing to go first and really create a human relationship to mental health.
And what type of feedback are you getting from employers?
You know, it's been really positive. I have to tell you, a lot of people have trepidation accessing EAP or accessing clinical support if they've never had a mental health imbalance. But we know now, coming out of the pandemic, it's like 1 in 3 suffer from depression or anxiety. So you throw in a coach offering resilience support, it's a little bit more accessible and less threatening. So the feedback has been that they're very happy that their staff are reaching out and getting a level of support to help themselves.
Well, that's good to hear that employers are taking on that. So now I want to think about the perspective of the employee, right? Especially having been an employee. So what is the first step that you think an employee could take if they want to bring up the topic of mental health in the workplace or just create a more compassionate environment by leading through example?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we all have a role in destigmatizing mental health. And we can all have the ability to lead from our seat. So from an employee perspective, you know, there's a couple of different routes that employees who are really out to cause change can do. They can work with their HR department to see if there's an opportunity to create an employee resource group for mental health. I was a leader of one at a large company. Employee resource groups are wonderful for bringing people together with shared experience. They might have a loved one who's suffering or they might be suffering. So those are great groups to create. But then also just talking themselves. And I'm not saying telling the world or telling their coworkers about their own illness. Going first and talking about a celebrity, going first and talking about an athlete who's openly disclosed anxiety or depression, start normalizing the conversation about mental health in general, and it'll be less of a thing in the workplace.
I agree. And I do think that, like you keep referencing, we're coming out of the pandemic. A lot of this stuff was happening before the pandemic, right? And it's just that the pandemic has finally put us, I almost describe it like being an alcoholic. We have bottomed out as a culture and a society. And so now we've had to stand up, brush ourselves off, look around and say, oh my gosh, there is a whole lot of mental health challenges going on around us. And we need to start destigmatizing it and talking about it in order to make it normal and to figure out how we can support one another and build our own resilience. Can you speak for just a second, and I know I might be putting you on the spot, but can you speak to just a second about what you mean when you're using the term resilience?
Oh, for sure. So a lot of times people sit and they wait to hit burnout. They wait to hit depression. They are unaware that the daily habits that they're doing, their daily routine, can either contribute to good emotional well-being or like pull the thread away from their mental health.
Oh, sister, so, you are singing my song.
So it's really it's taking a step back and saying, what do I do every day? Is what I'm doing every day contributing to good mental health, good emotional well-being? Or am I inadvertently, you know, overly consuming the news and not moving my body and not connecting and isolating? What are my daily habits and how are they contributing or not to being healthy and being resilient? So it's really just taking a step back and saying, what am I doing and what could I make little changes that could make a big difference?
I appreciate that you brought up the isolation part. I've been listening to this podcast series. It's actually based on relationships. But one of the things that they keep going back to is just the need for community, the need for connection and socialization, and how, you know, definitely COVID impacted that. But then also social media. You know, people are getting together, younger kids are getting together, and they're not even engaged. They're just staring at their phone. So building that sense of community is being a huge, huge factor in helping these people get out of the depression. And another point that she had made on it is it's something that, you know, when it comes to socializing, people, you know, there's some, it takes courage, right? It takes courage to put yourself out there and do that. And people think that friendships just happen, and they don't just happen. They take work. And I think, you know, especially some of the younger generations are not seeing that, not realizing that, not having modeled that relationships and connections do take some effort and work. So that's just something that's been bubbling in the back of my mind for days as a takeaway from this series, and I just feels like it just fits right in. But I want to go back to the workplace. So what would you tell a coworker who is dealing with a mental health issue? Not only what can you do to support that person, but what can they do to support themselves if a coworker has, you know, erratic behaviors or mood swings or is, you know, just hard to deal with?
So I think as a coworker, we have this tendency to look away or step over something and assume somebody else is gonna handle it, right? So the first thing, have the courage to address the situation. Don't look away. You could be the only person that's checking on what's really going on. And then don't feel like you have to fix it. Don't feel like you got to play the role of the clinician. And that's part of the reason why we look away. It's not comfortable. We don't have all the answers. You don't have to have all the answers. Just listen. Our generous listening and being that person that they can talk to can make all the difference. And then bridging them to resources that are available. What does your company offer? Is there an EAP? What's their relationship to talking to a professional? Just listening to kind of where they are and helping them arrive at the right answer for them can make a big difference.
I really appreciate that. And I do want to just ask you to explain what an EAP is. I know, but I think it's an acronym that many people might not know.
I was just going to ask that question. I'm like, I spent too much of my life self-employed. Maybe that's why, but I'm struggling and I'm thinking of all the things and I'm elephant, apple. No, she's going to have to tell me.
It's typically an 800 number that the benefits organization the company works with provides in case someone needs to call and get some type of support for it's, mental health.
It stands for Employee Assistance Program. And so what's the difference between that? Because I'm familiar with an EAP, an Employee Assistance Program, but you were also referencing employee resource groups. What's the difference?
Yeah, so employee assistance programs are run by benefits companies, and employee resource groups are like affinity groups. So they're actually organized within the organization and bring people, like-minded people together, or like ethnicities together. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's different groups, like there's Hispanic ERGs and there's, you know, African-American ERGs. But now more and more organizations are creating mental health employee resource groups.
Wow, that's fantastic to hear. And are you seeing anybody working towards creating family caregiver resource groups?
It's interesting that you ask that. No, I have not. But
well,
I think
good,
that's
because that's where Liza and I want to step in. So it's nice to hear there's a need and we can help fill it. I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you going to say, though? You were saying something
about
it, Michelle.
I think it's great. I think it's absolutely needed. I mean, you know, you look at how many employees when I was in my last organization, so many employees were caring for people at home. And that's a big community of people.
It mm-hmm. is. One in five. Yeah. Yep. That's our mantra. One in five. And so either you may be a family caregiver and not even know it yourself, because it's sometimes what we expect in our role as a daughter, a wife, a mother. And you can notice that I'm using female-based pronouns, right? But it is actually taking on more responsibilities. So we are listening to mental health advocate Michelle Dickinson talking about mental health in the workplace. After this short break, we're going to talk about Michelle's experience growing up with a bipolar mother and the book she wrote about it.